Hello, my name is Michelle Yana-Chan, the wandering book collector, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Writers Exploring What's Informed Their Books and Their Lives, around themes of movement, memory, sense of place, borders, identity, belonging, and home. In this edition, I'm joined by the writer Hilary Bratt to discuss her book, Taking the Risk, My Adventures in Travel and Publishing. Hilary, welcome to The Wandering Book Collector.
Hello, Michelle.
From the first couple lines of the book, Hilary, you acknowledge that many of your adventures have been unintentional. And I could argue, though, that you set yourself up for unintentional adventures, that you increase the chance of that by going to unfamiliar places that even a year earlier you couldn't locate on a map. So is there intention on your part, unconsciously even, to open yourself up to the unintentional?
Well, I think nature fitted me for the unintentional by giving me no sense of direction. And I start the book by explaining I have no sense of direction. So very often I don't quite know where I'm going, but as long as you're going somewhere and it's interesting, and at 3 years old, it was apparently quite interesting. So it works.
Mistakes and getting lost are often the foundation of a proper adventure, as you say. So I do wonder about the jobs you've taken, including leading tour groups, the remit of which is in part to protect tourists from mistakes and from getting lost. But that's when much of the proper adventure begins, surely.
Yes, I mean, there are two different things. You're right, getting lost doesn't usually happen as a tour guide. Sometimes, certainly if I'm on my own with the group. I've given it up now. If anyone listening is a bit anxious about this, I don't do tour leading anymore. But I sometimes got them lost on the way to a restaurant or something like that. But we always had local guides in the mountains. And actually, I'm much less lost in mountains. You know, it's a big vista and you're sort of heading towards the big mountain or the pass. And it's much easier to find your way, but cities are an absolute nightmare. And I could never write city guides for that reason. I'd always be lost.
And as the founder, Hilary, of Bratt Guides, you've spent decades publishing books to destinations around the world, from Albania to Zanzibar. But again, does that kind of steering, even hand-holding, remove some of the unpredictability and possibly the joys of travel?
Yes, I think probably in my favour is that I'm not a good businesswoman. And if I'd been a good businesswoman, I would have drawn up business plans and so on and thought, oh, well, I need to do popular destinations and just make them better. But as it was, I thought, what's the point in doing another book to Thailand or France? You know, let's cover the really unusual places, and then let's cover the unusual ways of traveling in the unusual places, just to make it even harder to sell the resulting book. But it did mean that we published books that a few people needed badly, rather than that we hoped a lot of people needed but actually didn't buy. And I think that's what kept us going for 50 years. Now I think about it. It's a new idea that I've just had, but I think that was quite important.
Near the beginning of your book, you mention a guidebook you used, published in the 1950s, called How to Travel Without Being Rich by Norman Ford. I must get my hands on a copy of that if a secondhand one is knocking around somewhere. When you see travellers today trying to give the impression of being rich, taking selfies and wearing branded sunglasses and, you know, backdropped by some striped graphics of a beach bar, do you sigh with relief at being born when you were? Or is that horribly smug of me? Can you still travel today like you traveled around South America in the 1970s?
To be honest, my paths don't cross with people looking, you know, trying to be rich. You know, I'm still a backpacker at the heart. I still hitchhike. I don't go to bars because I don't much like drinking, and I'm a little bit shy of new people experiences. I love new wildlife experiences. So I'm kind kind of shielded from that sort of world, and I think that's okay.
But it exists, Hilary, doesn't it? And I'm lucky to know about traveling without a smartphone. Like you, I know about being on the road without internet cafes. But when it was aerograms and poste-restante, which might be unfamiliar to some of my listeners, but I mean, to give them a taste of those good old days, you write in your book about meeting up with a friend called Linda in Lima. How did you fix up that rendezvous with her, for example?
That was amazing, actually, because I've traveled quite a lot alone, but I've never wanted to travel alone. It's just been whenever I've asked someone to travel with me, they said, "Oh, yes, lovely." And then a fortnight before we were due to leave, "Oh, by the way, I've met this wonderful man, I really can't go," or "I thought I'd get married," or "I thought I'd have a baby," or whatever people do. And so for the two long trips I started on my own, or certainly the long one, which was South America for 3 months. Linda was going to come, and then I think she'd met a new boyfriend. I think in the book I skate over that a bit, and I say she didn't want to be away for such a long time. So same sort of thing. But we did keep in touch. She did really want to go down the Amazon. And it was only letters in those days, so I would write an email letter, sorry, not email, airmail letter, and Linda would get it and reply. That would take probably about 3 weeks altogether. But just for some fluke, we met in Lima. I was just standing rather vacantly in a square in Lima trying to decide what to do next. And Linda sort of hit me like a whirlwind, and it was wonderful.
For clarity, when she replied to you, she'd reply to a kind of post office address, would she? And then you'd pick it up from a central post office in the capital.
Yes, I mean, older listeners will remember that. It was absolutely the highlight of traveling pre-internet. You went to Poste Restante in, or Liste de Correos, it was in South America, which was a post office. Very often the rather dim clerk there, you'd say Hilary Bratt, and so he'd look under H, and so you say no B, and you learned how to pronounce it phonetically, Bearadete. And he would find it, and it would be wonderful. And I say it would usually be about five letters, because my parents were very good at writing. My sister wrote a lot, other friends did, and it was absolutely wonderful, particularly when I was traveling on my own. You could then go and get several cups of coffee and read all the letters and feel really homesick, which is allowed, particularly if you're traveling alone. And it was a very special time, always just picking up the mail.
Yet I wonder, Hilary, if your parents and your sister and your friends would have enjoyed watching Instagram videos of your travels, live.
I can't imagine. I mean, they wouldn't know because my parents are dead and my sister's as old as I am, almost as old as I am. I don't think so. I think the excitement of getting a letter, I haven't thought about that because I'm sure my parents, the post would come, and I'm sure my mother would say, "Oh, there's a letter from Hillary." I'm sure she would. They loved getting my letters. It was 20 pages, perhaps, of real detail of what I was doing, and they didn't have any other contact with me. There was no phone calls or anything. So it was very special. It certainly honed my writing. I learned to write well, I hope, because of those letters home, which I've used in the book, and that's why I was able to write the book very quickly because I had all the letters that my mother had returned to me. And there it was, my day-to-day experiences in South America and Africa for whatever it was, 4 years.
Hilary, one of your favorite ways of moving around is hitchhiking, and me too. And I used to hitchhike without a second thought. I wonder why I think harder about it now. Is that me, or is that the world around us? It certainly feels like there are fewer travelers thumbing rides now.
It's a very good question, and I talk a lot about hitchhiking because I'm the only person I know who hitchhiked in their 80s. I hitchhiked last year at the age of 82, so that is a bit unusual. I don't think it's any more dangerous now, but it's perceived to be more dangerous. I don't know why. And so fewer people do it. And so the people who do, I just very few people do it. I mean, I stop for hitchhikers if I see them, with a bit of care. You know, I like them to look like travelers rather than escaped convicts. And I'm a bit careful about stopping for a single man or two men. But you know, I have stopped for single men, and it's been great. I've just felt that the vibe was right. But I think it's a real shame that people are much more suspicious now. I think social media spreads scare stories, maybe. I mean, I don't know anything about social media, but something has happened to make people think it's more dangerous. And I don't actually think it is. But as soon as people think it is, and there are fewer people doing it, people are less wanting to pick them up in case they're risky. You know, it's a risk both ways. It's a risk for the driver that they might pick up a convict, and it's a risk for the hitchhiker, particularly women, because they don't quite know. But you've hitchhiked, I've hitchhiked, and you meet wonderfully kind people.
In fact, you once said to me about 25 years ago how much I had to look forward to as I was getting older, because instead of getting flashed or some such, I'd have people giving me their seat on a crowded bus. So perhaps, as the years roll on, it will just also get more straightforward. I'll be 82, thumbing a ride.
There's so much advantage to traveling when you're older. You know, hitchhiking obviously is safer. I mean, let's face it, an 82-year-old is less likely to be raped than a 22-year-old. And people stop, oh, poor old lady, you know, is there something wrong? So you can exploit your old age. And people are kind, they're thoughtful. You remind them of their mothers in Africa or whatever. You know, it's a shame that people worry about getting older, because from the travel point of view, just embrace it, listeners, because it's wonderful.
Hilary, your book reminded me not only how we used to travel, but also how places used to be devoid of tourists in some cases, such as the Galapagos, where you went in the 1970s, and the Inca Trail. The trail's been etched into the Andes for centuries, of course, but it was new to backpackers when you went. And you describe having a map, I quote, "a rather faint photocopied handwritten description, complete with drawings created by a Swedish hiker." You don't need me to tell you that 1.5 million tourists visited Machu Picchu last year. The first time I visited, there were also no other tourists there. It was much later in 93, but it was just after the Shining Path insurgent group had been in action. So lucky us, right? But given that privilege, our first footprint kind of travel, can we lecture the next generation of travellers about responsible travel and about regulations and the perils of over-tourism?
Yes, I think it's something we need to think about very unsmugly. You know, it's not so much now, but there used to be a great thing. I'm a traveler, you're a tourist. I'm superior, you're inferior. You know, you go on holidays, I'm a real traveler, I go away for months. That's completely fake. You know, someone on a fortnight's holiday can do just as much good, have just as much of a good time for themselves and for the place that they go, as someone who's traveling for several months. So I would want to completely get rid of the distinction between a holiday and travel. You know, it's up to the individual. I do think we were lucky. I mean, to have discovered, in quotes, the Inca Trail. I didn't discover it, and it'd be lovely actually if the Swedish people who created that first illustrated map, if they recognize themselves through your podcast or through anything that I've written, because this is what did it. You know, it was handwritten, it had little drawings, for instance, of a steaming pile of human feces saying that not to defecate by the trail. You know, it was very, very helpful. And I think we would have done it anyway, because we'd heard about it, and I describe in the book how I saw it when I went to Machu Picchu in 1969. I looked back along the trail towards Cusco, and it was very faint then, and I thought, I wonder if this leads to Cusco. And I think we were adventurous enough, we probably would have found it anyway. And we found a lot of other new trails, you know, that really were new, that only the locals knew about. But, you know, we were so lucky that 1973, which was when we did the Inca Trail, I think it had only been known by backpackers, by gringos, probably for maybe a year before that. It was a very new experience, but it was so amazing. Of course, word of mouth led us to it before we found this photocopied bit of paper.
I mean, does that also mean, Hillary, that you hold your hand up and say, I paved the way for millions of people to come trampling this trail afterwards?
It would have happened anyway, wouldn't it? I mean, already, even when we were doing it, the trekking companies were just starting to get interested. And I mean, I'm proud that we were the first people to describe it in print, but it would be wrong to pretend that it hadn't been for us. No one would have discovered it. Of course they would, and someone else would have described it. So it was it's one of the wonders of the world. It would have been, you know, it needed to be found. And actually, it's been, in my opinion, very well managed. It got to a state of too many tourists, and they limited the numbers. They cut down on litter. They made designated campsites. You know, when I've done it about 4 or 5 times, I think now, with groups. And in the early days, you could camp anywhere. You could defecate anywhere to be disgusting, you know. People lit fires against the stones, the Inca stones, and cracked them. There was no management. And then people complained, oh, you know, we can't camp, we can't wild camp. This is terrible. But of course it's not terrible. You have to manage tourist numbers whenever tourism becomes popular in a place.
You wrote something in Kenya about the Maasai. It's this. You said you'd seen photos but had cynically wondered if they were real or just set up for the tourists. I was reflecting on that because I mean, is that how it should be, in fact? Should the authentic traditional dance happen over there, out of sight, Maasai only, and then some version of it set up over here for the tourists who pay to see it? What do you think?
If I'm understanding the question right, because it's quite a subtle question, because I've led so many trips now to places with local people, in quotes, native dances, in many quotes, folk dances, and so on, and I've seen the absolutely authentic version of local culture. It's very difficult. I personally don't like dances put on for tourists. I dislike watching them, to be quite candid. But people love it. When I've led trips, you know, and in Madagascar, it was quite a sort of contrived thing. You know, the Malagasy people don't really do these native dances a lot. But you know, they were kind of they were authentic, but they were for the tourists and the people. It keeps them engaged with their culture, and they do then you dress in their native, you know, their traditional clothing, and it's a very interesting subject, and I thought a lot about it because I think sometimes as tourists we want people to look primitive. And you know, I'm saying unacceptable words, but you know what I mean, primitive with lots of quotes around it. But we do, you know, if they have a bone through their nose and are dressed in a loincloth, it's much more exciting than if they're dressed in Texas Oil Company t-shirts, even if that's what they wear normally. So it's difficult to say. I think it does persuade some local people to keep their culture that they may be quite happy to discard, but it also can be inauthentic. You know, it's not really what the people are doing when tourists aren't around. So I'm in a muddle about it, as you can tell, but I think it's a very interesting question.
You know, I mean, I'm in a muddle about it too. you had that really interesting experience that you write about in the book in Chipaya, where you took interesting photographs, you write, but didn't pay for the privilege of that. And it was a village that had been studied anthropologically, and so they had an understanding that this was a kind of transaction. And you wrote that you didn't feel like it was a sensitive kind of good traveling experience, but it was personally fascinating. And is that still going on, that conflict for you, Hilary? That's a long time ago.
I'm really glad you asked that you mentioned Chipaya, because it was a turning point. We'd always felt, we want to visit Indians. Indians, now it's Indigenous people, but in the 70s, we all said Indians. And we're genuinely interested in their culture. We'd met a lot of anthropologists when we were traveling. So it was a sincere wish. It wasn't just to get lovely photos. It was really to understand another culture. But I don't really think we should have been there. We were tourists. I got some amazing photos, like a woman breastfeeding a lamb, and that's something I've never forgotten. And it was a perfectly natural thing for her. Sort of any young animal was so valuable that if she had milk and there wasn't a mother sheep for you, then fine. But I do... recalling it, and even at the time, we felt uncomfortable. We weren't very welcome in the village. We were chased out of one part of the village because it was rather in two parts. And we went to a fiesta, but it was rather a dour fiesta. There wasn't much merrymaking, a lot of drinking, and they didn't want us there. And, they started hitting us, and we left. But, it was their village, and I'm very glad we went there, because it made me think about our impact on a very rural place. I mean, we had to walk for a day and a half to get there. It was very, very isolated. And I'm glad I did it, but I don't think I should have done it.
I wanted also to talk about your experiences in Chile and Argentina in 1973 and 1974, a politically contentious time. And you wrote that it taught you a lot about the optics on a place from far away versus on the ground. And you stated that it was those experiences that led you to publish certain guidebooks, specifically on Burma, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. What was it that made you want to get those guidebooks out there?
It was absolutely definitive in my travel life. Before that, it was, we weren't going to go to South Africa. One should boycott any country whose government you didn't approve of. And it was, we didn't even learn that Allende had been overthrown until we were on the Chilean border and buying our train ticket to go into Chile. So, we could have changed our mind, but we thought, we'll go. And as a good Guardian reader, I was pro Allende. I was appalled that he'd been overthrown, democratically elected government, as all the newspapers said. But our experience with the Chileans, the more sophisticated people in Santiago, and the drivers who picked us up hitchhiking, so they weren't a cross section of the society. They were the more privileged. So would be biased against a communist leader, probably. But nevertheless, their description of how their farms have been forcibly taken over. I mean, Alberto, who I described at some detail, because he invited us to his farm. And, he had seven thoroughbred horses, and they'd been slaughtered for meat. And, that was just such a waste. And, he said to us, as horses are nice people. And I remember that comment. And, the productivity of the farms collapsed. It was a real eye-opener, because we both had to completely change our opinions and really just keep an open mind. I'm not saying Pinochet was wonderful, but at the time, the people were hugely relieved to see Allende go. And I think the same people would have felt very disenchanted with Pinochet later. But one does need to listen. And it's so easy as a Westerner to go into a very different country with a preconceived set of ideas and expect what you see and experience to live up to expectations. Well, it often doesn't. And a good traveler will keep a completely open mind and be like a sponge, you know, listen, hear what people are saying, and just think, I wasn't there. They were living the experience. It's different.
Which is why you wanted to give exposure to some countries that might not have otherwise had a guidebook written about them, and maybe not therefore had travellers think about it as a place to go, and it influenced you in that way, to kind of get people to find out the truth.
It made you know, I'm really pleased actually that I had that experience and therefore realised that as a traveller you have the opportunity of meeting ordinary people. And if you boycott a country, you're never going to meet the ordinary people, quite honestly. You're going to meet the opinions of journalists who've been to that country, but the journalists will be writing according to the publication that they're writing for. And so a traveller in, say, somewhere like North Korea, which I've been to, and was an amazing experience. Because, you know, we had some opportunity just to talk to ordinary people. And that did completely change any feeling that, oh, no, we can't write about Burma, we can't write about South Africa because the government doesn't respect human rights. There's always a story. There's always another side to the story. It may not be a very pretty side, but we should hear all the sides.
Publishing those guidebooks to those four countries would still be unusual today, though not everything stays the same. And I noted how when you were overlanding from South Africa to Egypt, you stitched a Union Jack flag on your backpack, and your husband, an American, stitched the Stars and Stripes, hoping that would help you both thumb a lift. You probably wouldn't do that now.
That's a good point, actually. I'm sure you wouldn't do it now, unless you were very sure. And it did work. You know, someone, the driver would either be pro-American, or sometimes they were American, or pro-British. The interesting thing is the really pro-British ones were the Ugandans, because they'd had, ever since they really liked the British colonial regime, because ever since independence, they'd had some really fairly crummy rulers. You know, they'd had Obote, who wasn't much good, and then Idi Amin, who was there when we were there. So it's interesting. We experienced reverse racism there. We were favored because we were white, and it was really embarrassing. You know, people would see us and they'd usher us up the front of a queue and give us the best seats wherever we were. And it was absolutely genuine. You know, they liked to see white people, and there weren't many white people in Uganda, not many tourists, because it was Idi Amin, and people were a bit nervous of going there. So it was just about our favorite country in Africa in the 70s, despite Idi Amin, because the people were absolutely lovely.
I wonder if there's ever moments when you feel hopeless, kind of without hope. I mean, the example I think of was when you first visited Madagascar in the 70s, in 1976, I think, and you returned less than 10 years later, and there was no coral, you wrote, at Nosy Komba, and dynamited by fishermen, and that the lemurs managed now, and managed in inverted commas by the island's villagers, were charging a fee to see them. And I wonder if there are, you know, there are moments when you go to the Inca Trail and think this is being managed well, as you said, but other times when you throw your hands in the air.
I'm an incorrigible optimist, and I'm probably lucky. I do tend to see the good side of things. You know, that's just sort of nature. I mean, my nature. I see a lot of good in Madagascar. I mean, it's easy to see the deforestation, the destruction of the coral that you talk about. And that really is sad, a place where in 1973 you could just snorkel, wade in and snorkel and see lobsters and coral and lots of fish. That's all being decimated by overpopulation. But the conservation is very well managed now. There are lots of NGOs planting trees, doing really dramatic conservation efforts, doing wildlife corridors so that the lemurs can commute from one patch of forest to another. And so I see the mixture. I see the increased population. I mean, Madagascar is now, well, it was 11 million when I went there. Was it 11 million? And it's now, I've
27,
forgotten
I
actually,
think you
but
wrote. Yeah, I think you wrote 27 million.
it's something like five times. It's quite ridiculous how much more it is. And of course, all these people have needs. They need to eat, so they deforest. I don't blame the local people, but it is that's depressing. But I do tend to see the good as well, and I see more national parks and more care over conservation. So not everyone agrees with me, and my optimism is a bit irritating for some people, but that's how I see it.
No, it's very cheering, Hilary. I want to ask you about home, Hilary. I sense where you are is home because I can see bookshelves and maps behind you in a globe. And where is home?
Yes.
Whereabouts is home?
Yes, you're looking at a very cluttered office come activity room in my house in Seaton in Devon. And I moved from Buckinghamshire to Devon to Seaton in 2008, so quite a few years ago now. And I love living in Devon. I'm really proud to live in Devon. And there's, it's a beautiful county, there's lots to do. And of course, I welcome the internet in that I can now keep in touch with the office. I'm semi-retired, not completely retired, but not doing day-to-day activities. It doesn't matter, of course, now there's email. In the old days, I would have had to write a letter to them. I couldn't have lived here, but email and internet, all those things. It's enabled people to work from home in very widely displaced places, like you and I are talking to. You're in Singapore.
I am. I'm in Singapore. Yeah, very
I'm
far
not even
away.
sure where you
Yes,
are.
exactly right. At, I'm 7 hours ahead of you. It sounds like you've found a kind of a new county, which is home. And you mentioned in the book how much you love England. I wonder if it's because of all your travels that England feels so much like home.
Is. I've worked abroad such a lot that I've always loved going back home. And there are things, little things like public footpaths. When I first got back after 6 years abroad, seeing a green public footpath sign brought tears to my eyes, because it's so English. It's so special. Our network of footpaths, our bluebells, I love England, I really do. I love travel, but I'm very happy to be now in England. I don't want to live abroad again.
And are you working on other books, Hilary, either whether it's updates to guidebooks or new destinations, or will we be reading more non-fiction or travelogue by you?
I don't know. One thing at a time. I don't really want to do another guidebook. Doing a good guidebook is hard work. So updating, I've done three local guidebooks to Devon, Slow Devon, and other people are updating them now very well, more energetic people. And I'm doing other things. I do a lot of sculpture now. I sell my sculpture sometimes. I do sculpture from scrap metal and forging and welding and stuff. So, it's nice to experience other things. I had a wonderful travel life, but it does, and writing. I tend to write about past events. On the other hand, something always happens. I think, oh, I could write about that. And so I do, and it's fine. But writing, taking the risk was such a pleasure because I was able to throw everything into that one book. So there may not be another one, but there may. We'll see.
I have a sense, though, that there are boxes of notebooks and letters, maybe in the room that I'm talking to you in, that still haven't necessarily found a receptacle.
You could be right, Michelle. You could be right.
Well, I hope to read more written words by you, Hilary. Thank you so much for joining me on the Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.